Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight is the first of a two-part interview with David Paulides. If you're a Patreon, you already have this entire interview, and there'll be a little extra piece with it, too. It's not very long, but it's a little extra segment I'll be putting out for patrons only later on. Everything that's been released for patrons is available if you become a patron. You can go back into the sort of archive on the Patreon page. And eventually, when I figure out how, there will be a members section as well. If you want to become a patron, and it's only $3 to become a patron, $3 a month, and you can't use the patron site for some reason, get in touch with me. We can work something out over PayPal, as I've had to do with a number of people from around the world. By becoming a patron, you get interviews like this, multi-part interviews ahead of time, in full, so you don't have to wait a week to hear the second part, or third part in some cases. You get extra snippets with guests, and the occasional bits of free stuff here and there. Primarily, it helps us continue the show at the quality that it is, and hopefully add more shows as we go. I am still working on merchandise, but everyone who is going to design stuff for me has been exceedingly busy, so hopefully soon. We're also going to be doing a raffle, and I haven't quite worked out how I'm going to do this yet. A listener donated something very, very cool to us, and we're going to give this away in a raffle, I think, and I have some secondary prizes as well, so that way it will up the chance of people actually winning something if you buy a raffle ticket. But I will get into the details of that in the next few weeks as I figure out exactly how I'm going to do it. As for tonight, as I said, we're going to be talking with David Paulides, and I did this interview last night. His new book is Missing 411, Hunter's Unexplained Experiences. And it covers just what it sounds like. It's different hunters that have gone missing. He explains why he picks up, focuses in on hunters as well. We talk about the documentary that he was on about a year ago talking about when you can hope to see that, as well as plenty of other stuff. These cases get weirder as they go, and part two has some of the really strange cases that are in this book. And it has to be repeated because people don't seem to, not everyone seems to get this, but do not buy the Missing 411 books on Amazon. You are going to get ripped off. Go to canammissing.com. It is the only place you can officially buy these books. They're $25. Amazon sells them for well over $100 because people can get away with it. Same with eBay. So go to canammissing.com if you want to buy these books. All right. With no further ado, this is part one of my talk with David Paulides. And I'm talking tonight with David Paulides. So welcome back to the show, David.
Hey, thanks, Soraya. My pleasure.
And you have a brand new book out. You want to tell people what this is? This one is focused on?
It's centered on hunters, armed hunters that go into the woods and don't come back. And we started tracking these maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and just over the number of cases, it just became overwhelming that there was parallels between the hunters and the hikers. And we thought we'd put it to print.
Okay. Why did you think that hunters were important enough to merit their own book?
Well, I think they're a unique subset of what we've put out there before. Namely, they're armed and they can protect
and they generally.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And they generally know the woods.
Exactly. A lot of these guys and ladies have gone to the same area for decades, and it's not like a casual person who goes out maybe for a one-time weekend hike into an area they've never been in. These guys really know the area, and to see that they vanished makes no sense.
All right. What, for people who are not familiar with your work, what makes a missing person case a missing 411 case as opposed to just a missing person?
For starters, there's 59 geographical clusters of missing people in North America. And this evolved over the last 6 years of studying missing persons cases and reading thousands of them. And from that, there's certain criteria that kind of float to the top. And after you read hundreds of them and you see, okay, tracking dogs can't pick up a scent, or bloodhounds walk in a circle and lay down, or five teams of dogs come in and they can't find a scent from the location the person was last seen. Or searchers find a body in an area that's been searched dozens and dozens of times. Or a body is found in extremely close proximity to water. I mean, there's specific profile points that we lay out at the beginning of the book that I think after you read the book, you go, wow, you know, those are really obvious. And it's hard to explain why a plane flying over a field, and a plane has forward-looking infrared radar in it, they fly over the field or the mountain and they don't see anything. They don't see a body emitting heat. And months later, the body's found right where they flew over and they didn't see anything. And I think it's those type of things that after I just inundate you with so many that it'll be obvious to the reader, okay, there's a point there to be made. Now, in some of the reviews and some of my previous books, people have made comments that, well, it's so repetitious, the stories kind of get boring. And I think the readers need to understand that if I gave you two or three stories where there were the same elements in it, people would say, oh, that's just a coincidence, or, you know, you throw enough stories at it, there's bound to be a few that match. But if I throw dozens and dozens at you, and they all have the same basic profile to them, you start to think, oh, there's something here.
Yeah, and a lot of these people aren't found in this book.
Correct.
And, of course, many of them who are found in locations that were searched, which makes no sense. I mean, there's no way they were missed during the initial search attempts.
And that's exactly what I want to put out there, is that this isn't an indictment on the search and rescue teams, because I think they do a superb job. They do cover these areas really well. And for some reason, I don't think the body or the person was there when they searched. And in previous books, I've stated that one instance, a small child was found laying on top of a tree, laying across a trail that search and rescue people took out every day out to their search zone. So it's almost as though the body was placed there to be found by the search teams going out. But this happens time after time after time, so...
And how far back do these cases go? You have some from the mid to late 1800s in here, correct?
Right. And in general, we've got one case from another book back to 1752. But in this book, late 1800s.
Yeah. So this is not something that just started. This is something that's been going on for centuries. And who knows how long before that we didn't have the appropriate records to find them.
Exactly. I think there is a historical significance to it. And even the cluster zones have that same historical aspect to it.
Now, when it comes to the cluster zones, are there any similarities between them?
Well, I think that's part of the uniqueness to it, is that many of them are national parks. And the biggest cluster in the world of missing people that fit the profile, Yosemite National Park. And then as you follow the Cascades further north, you can go right up through Oregon and Washington and find a series of national parks and forests that have these clusters in them, and it can't be refuted because there are these same missing persons cases there where people have never been found. And I think the commonality at the beginning was national forests, and we slowly started to disperse out and figure that, well, national forests have it, and even some rural areas have the same thing. And in Canada, there's national parks that fit this criteria as well. So national parks, forests, and rural areas are covered in this book.
And most of these disappearances happen in proximity to water.
Let me correct something. First of all, national parks are not in this book because you can't hunt in a national park.
All right.
That would be a jail time for you. So corrected that. I'm sorry. Go ahead with your question again.
Most of these disappearances seem to happen in proximity to water.
That seems to be the case. And in other books, I've addressed that as well. And I don't know quite what to make of that.
What about type of rock that the ground is made of? I know boulder fields play a big factor in this, and granite. Do you see any other things come up regularly?
You know, you hit the biggest ones, but I was in Australia a couple months ago, and I gave a presentation in three cities there. And what I wanted to make them aware of was Yosemite, but then I showed them the locations where people have disappeared in Australia, and they are also in these locations with these giant boulder fields, giant pieces of granite. Several of the sites would remind you of Yosemite just because how large the granite is, and it's odd the way that comes up.
Well, it's interesting because in folklore, a lot of those areas are also where fairies and little people and things like that are supposed to dwell.
That's correct. I mean, I did a piece in one book about, I think it was Iceland, where they will actually make a road go around a giant boulder rather than move the boulder because they believe entities live inside.
And when you were in Australia, did you break up? Was it in Australia you broke a bone?
Yeah, I broke my fibula in my left leg.
How did that happen?
Well, we were filming a segment on a woman who disappeared, and we were way back in the forest area. It had rained the night before, so the rocks and things were really slick. I was carrying an expensive camera on my shoulder. I had a big backpack on, and I went over the top of one of these boulders on the trail and kind of slipped off the backside. My leg kind of twisted open, and I did everything I could not to drop this really expensive camera. And what I did is everyone there goes, uh-oh, because you could hear it crack.
Oh.
And the good thing was I didn't drop the camera. The bad thing was I broke my left leg. But being a hard-headed soul that I am, I stood there for a while and go, oh, this is bad. And I just cinched my boot up as hard as I could, and we walked out of like another 2.5 miles.
Oh, man. Yeah, didn't it take you a day or so to get it looked at or something?
No, the truth is we had another 9 days or so in Australia, and it just blew up like a huge melon. And I said, you know what? This is bad. If I go to the doctor, they're going to cast it or something, and it's just going to ruin the trip. I'll just gut it out, put my boot on as tight as I can, and keep going. And we did, and we finished segments, and we did the filming, and I ended up walking into a orthopedics office outside of Denver, and the physician goes, well, it can't be broken. It's got to be just torn ligaments and tendons. I said, really? He goes, oh, yeah, because you wouldn't be able to walk in on that. So they take an x-ray of it, and they walk into the back room with me. They go, come here. And two doctors are standing there. They go, okay, we've had this practice for 20 years. Nobody has ever walked in with a broken fibula. You win the tough guy award. Oh, God.
Well, and that was, you were filming for the documentary?
No, we're actually filming, on. If you go to Can-Am Missing on YouTube, we put up three segments that we filmed in Australia on missing people. They're free. Okay. You can watch them.
And what's going on with the documentary? I think it was about a year ago you came on talking about it initially.
Documentary's done. It's submitted to two film festivals. We're not saying which ones. But George Knapp talked about it on Coast to Coast. He gave us huge accolades. And I'd say we've let it be seen by just a handful of people, overwhelmingly positive feedback. And I do think that the people are going to be proud to see it. I think the guys did a good job.
When do you think the public might have access to it?
So the rules are in film festivals, they have to premiere at the film festival, otherwise they won't even review it.
Right.
So once we're approved and once it's seen there, then we'll release it to the public. But until then, we haven't even sent out any DVDs or things to our Kickstarter supporters because we can't.
Hmm. No.
So I'm guessing late this year, early next year.
Okay. Well, that's not too bad. And as long as you're happy with it.
I'm super happy with it.
Maybe it'll open some eyes.
Well, there's a lot of people who don't want to read a book, but I think that there's a lot more people who would sit and watch a movie. And I think this one will grab you because it involves missing kids, it involves the outdoors, and it involves the unknown. So I think it'll be appreciated by the people who for sure know the topic.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about one of the cases in the book. Why don't we start with Jerry Hayes? He was only 5 years old.
Yeah, Jerry. That's a really. It was actually first seen in one of my other books a couple of years ago. But what I've done is I've taken a handful of cases from those other books that match the Hunter cases, and I've put them in here. But this was an older one back in 1938, November 10th. He was in Rucker Canyon in the Chiricahua Mountains of Arizona. And what I need to tell people about this is that location was just 8 miles south of the Chiricahua National Monument. And there's been three people that have vanished there and never been found. Specifically, Paul Fugate, who was a National Park Ranger, the only on-duty ranger ever to disappear and never be found. And in just the last year, two people have disappeared from that national monument and never been found. So this would qualify as part of that cluster, although this was just outside the monument itself. Rucker Canyon has an elevation of about 6,000 to 7,500 feet. His family set up a hunting camp at the lower elevations. And on November 10th, sometime during that day, the family and friends lost track of Jerry. He just sort of disappeared. And they searched, they found nothing, and they called the county sheriff. Well, within 10 days, they had more than 1,000 people in Arizona looking for this little guy. And they thought they had everything covered. And they were confused because the canyon they were in was almost a box canyon surrounded by high mountains. And it didn't seem as though there was really an area for him to escape to, unless he went out the way that they came in, and that was covered. Well, the family knew that he couldn't go far because he was a really frail boy, and he had rheumatism, and he never wandered far. Well, a week intensive search found nothing. And it was during that time that the military came in, and they committed searchers. They stated that 150,000 acres had been searched. And the sheriff came out and publicly made a statement that he had no idea what happened to the boy. Well, now you fast forward 9 days, and November 19th, a group of searchers were off their normal grid, and they saw faint tracks going uphill on this mountain. And the tracks were small, and it didn't make any sense, and they knew they were all out of their area, and they weren't supposed to be in this area, but they decided, oh, what the heck, we're going to follow it. And they went 1,000 feet up a steep hillside. And they were 4.5 miles from the camp where Jerry disappeared. Well, they found Jerry deceased, laying on the ground with no shoes or socks. His coat was missing, even though the temps at night had gone into the 30s. And the coroner stated that Jerry died of exposure. Well, the question comes up is that the boy never wandered far. He was frail. He had rheumatism. Nobody believed he'd leave his family, and nobody would believe that he would take his shoes and socks off and walk around in the bare mountains without some protection. That makes no sense. But I know that you know this, but the people who haven't heard me before, the absence of specific clothing or shoes and socks is another one of those elements that doesn't make any sense here. And lastly, he was found 1,000 feet up a hillside, and if you've wandered 4.5 miles, why would you just aimlessly go up a hillside? Doesn't make any sense either.
Especially when you have health problems that are going to limit how easily you could do something like that.
Correct.
I mean, the thing that stood out to me about this is that they could see the tracks where he went up. Why would a five-year-old kid who has rheumatism, climb a freezing mountain?
Yeah, it doesn't comprehend to me, unless, you know, something was enticing him up there, something was prodding him up there, who knows?
Or he was confused.
Yeah, I'd have to be really confused.
Yeah, I mean, like, completely disoriented.
Right.
And even so, you wouldn't think he would be able to, from the sounds of the report. It seems like that climb was pretty rugged.
Well, to me, when I read these reports, I always think, well, how do we even know that the searchers saw what they saw? Well, they might have seen some tracks going up there, and they followed the tracks up to where the body was, but how do we specifically know those were Jerry's tracks?
True. They may have just assumed that since they were looking for them.
Right. And they ended up there, so it had to be. But I don't take that kind of stuff for granted, because there's too many times I've read reports and I've read news articles, and one article says A and the other article says Z, and they're completely polar opposite from one another. So in an old case like from 1938 where information is limited, I kind of, you know, take it for a grain of salt.
But it still does fit the pattern pretty closely.
Yeah, it does.
And the thing is, when they don't find someone, I mean, that's weird, but it doesn't give us anything more to go on. When you find the body and the person doesn't have any obvious cause of death, that makes it even stranger.
Well, and I put this in many books, is that in this case, when they said that he died of exposure, I think a lot of times a coroner in a very small area may say something to quell the concerns of the community when in reality they may not even know. And in reading many, many, many cases like this, it's getting to be more apparent that in a lot of times they're getting more comfortable saying they don't know what caused the death. And I think looking back in time, you don't see that as often, but science has progressed, and the ability of a medical examiner to figure out cause of death has progressed a lot in 50 years. So really, it should almost be just the opposite. But we're seeing more people come out and saying, yeah, we don't know what caused this death.
Yeah. One of the things that you note in the book is that a lot of these people are found face down. And that's not normal. Is that correct?
Well, I think it's normal. In my world, it's not normal. Because when somebody gets tired, they tend to lay down. And when you lay down, you're never going to lay face down in the dirt. And when I think of somebody getting put down on the ground, I'm thinking about them being put either face down or laying on their back. And I have never, almost in all of these cases, heard of anybody being found on their back. They're always found face down. And there's a series of things that I think about in my mind that if I was the investigator on scene, what I'd be looking for, but it's never in any of the reports. I'd be looking for dirt in the mouth, dirt in the nose, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And there's never a mention of that, which makes me think that the person's dead before they hit the ground. And if they hit the ground that hard, there should be some sort of injuries to the face, nose, eye socket, et cetera. And you never hear about that either.
So it's more like they were just placed there carefully.
Well, that's kind of what it looks like. And those cases where a search area is gone over dozens of times and the person's not there, then all of a sudden they go back and the person's found their face down, it really is suspect.
Yeah. Because it seems like even if you fell forwards, if you were exhausted and you fell forwards, you would probably roll over on your back.
Or, you know, just the common human element is if you're going to fall forward, you're going to put your hands out in front of you.
Yeah. And if it happened once, it would be one thing. But it's a common element in these cases when the person is found.
Yep, correct.
And, of course, the clothes being removed is a lot of people will throw that over to just being hypothermia, because it is known in some cases in hypothermia, people will start to feel really warm and start removing their clothes. But not all of these cases happen in the cold, where hypothermia would explain it. And the boots missing is almost like, it seems like it's 90 to 95% of the cases the boots are missing, whether they have other clothes on or not.
Correct. And what I tell people is I say, okay, start paying attention to Mount Everest, high mountain climbers, when they get hypothermia. Do you ever hear about them stripping down naked? Ever? I've never heard that. I've never heard of a mountain climber being found without boots or socks. Ever. And there's a group of guides that have gone to Everest. And if you talk to them and you ask them if they ever heard of that, They've never even heard of that. So if that is a consistent element of hypothermia, then why shouldn't that transgress into high mountain climbing?
Yeah. All right. We'll leave some of the more stranger cases to last. Let's look at Bobby Boatman.
Well, Bobby's case happened in the Blue Mountains, kind of near a place called Godman Springs in Walla Walla. He was 14 years old, about 30 miles south of Dayton, Washington. Bobby was hunting with a group of older friends. He was last seen on a ridge on October 14, 1951, hunting. And that first night that he didn't come back, there was a huge snowstorm that hit the area. And the weather was so extreme that the local ranger stated that it took out communications for that entire area and all the searchers that went in there. And it snowed so much, it got up to their waist deep within just days. That's a big snowstorm. And what I talk about in the books is one of the things every hunter should do before they go out is check the weather. And that's like number one. Number two is you tell somebody where you're going exactly. And if you're not out by a certain date and time, that person calls authorities. Just a few things that you need to do. But there was a huge 7-day search, and they just scoured that mountainside. They found nothing. Well, 5 years after Bobby vanished, hunters in the Blue Mountains found a rifle and a red, like, knit cap, that same type he was wearing. And they were found near a place called Godman Springs. Well, they took the .30 caliber Remington rifle and the cap, and they turned it over to the sheriff. And the sheriff came down and took it to a guy that knew Bobby that sold him the gun, or his parents the gun, and the cap that was found in the bush, and they were positively identified as being his. So the sheriff went back up into the area, and he found a scattering of human bones. And one article stated, quoting, "They were found under suspicious stirring circumstances." Well, the bones and things were, they were all ID'd as Bobby's, and the deputies at the scene at the time said Bobby had apparently been buried under a tree and then covered up with dirt. And this incident happened about 100 yards from where they found his rifle. Now, the sheriff stated he didn't know if foul play was happening or not, but that on October 17, 1956, Bobby used a rope as his belt. And this was found on a sandbar in a box canyon, along with a sheath for his knife. And it was a long ways from the ridge that he was last seen on, and a long ways from where his body was found. Now, the people who found the rifle and the cap indicated it appeared, in a quote, that they were dropped as he was running. Now, bears and mountain lion would not take a knife and a sheath, you know, a mile away and put it on a sandbar. And if there was human involvement, why wouldn't they take his rifle or his cap? And why would anyone take the time, anyone, to bury Bobby under a tree and not hide the rifle? Now, burying somebody under a tree, I don't think people understand how difficult this is, especially a big tree. Trying to maneuver around roots and then digging down in hard soil, this is a monumental task. If a human was involved in burying the body, then why not dispose of the evidence around it, most predominantly the rifle and the cap?
Right.
Now, this case is very similar to another one in this book, one Donald McDonald case on 1215, 49, 17 years old at the time, never found. Very similar circumstances, kind of the same area. This is one of those cases where very strange.
Normally, I would think if you buried someone under a tree, chances are you're never going to find them.
Oh, I would say so. Probably the only way to find them would be, you know, 50, 60 years later when the tree falls over. That might be some remnants of bones, but maybe not.
Yeah, and when you look at a case like this, none of this makes any sense, because being buried under a tree implies that someone or something else was there.
Well, yeah.
And if they were, as you said, why would they leave this stuff? I mean, an animal, okay, maybe, but who took and put stuff on, in any case, who would take that stuff and put it on a sandbar?
Correct.
I mean, that's just bizarre. Unless you're intentionally trying to throw people off and not have them put pieces together, but who's going to do that and why?
Well, then you think about the bizarre coincidence of somebody even finding a sheath for a knife on a sandbar and turning it in.
Yeah.
I mean, if I found something like that, I don't even think I'd give it a second thought. I would just leave it there and keep going.
Right. Or someone might be like, oh, cool, I got a new knife sheath.
Yeah. No, it's very odd that these were all found and they were turned in and they were able to put the pieces together and make a very unusual story out of it. But I don't think anybody was able to adequately explain it away.
And it completely rules out an animal killing him and then burying him under a tree. I mean, are there any animals that would even do something similar?
I don't know of any. And even if there was an animal that killed him, then you would think that predation on that location would have been seen. Or remember, there was up to half a body width of snow during the search. You'd think that they would have seen it.
Right.
Because the rifle would have sunk down in the snow, and you might not have seen that. But if he was dead, there would have been blood everywhere. It would have been a scene that you could have observed from yards and yards away.
Now, one of the things you point out here is the incidence of bad weather surrounding a lot of these disappearances. Now, some of that could just be due to time of year or elevations, couldn't it?
Sure. I mean, absolutely. And all of these things could have a very mundane explanation. But when, again, you look at dozens and dozens of them and the same thing keeps happening every time, you start to think, you know what? How many times could coincidence strike like that?
Yeah. And you got to wonder if there is something doing this, are they watching the weather? Or is the weather a side effect of something else? Because some of these storms come up very suddenly, don't they?
That's true. And as in this case that we just talked about, but you got to remember, and I'm acutely made aware of this by people listening to your show and others that hear me, and they say, you guys keep forgetting that the U.S. can manipulate weather. I mean, we've been manipulating weather for decades, cloud seeding. There's a lot of rumors out there that we have more advanced measures to manipulate weather.
Sure.
So, I mean, if we can do it, as dumb as we are as humans, who really knows what can, right?
Sure. And that leaves a very big door open.
Absolutely.
Because there's the things we can think of, and then there's the things that may be out there that we have we've never even imagined.
Well, this is the part where people will turn off the radio and say, oh, these guys are just talking about wacky stuff. Hey, unless you have an open mind in all of this kind of research, then you're going to be hitting your head against a brick wall day in and day out. But just like you said, it's pretty apparent that weather is involved in these cases, and it comes up more times than not.
It's also apparent that these cases don't make sense, and it's something, like you said, that a lot of the cases seem like carbon copies of one another, and that's one of the ways they're carbon copies of one another. You look at the end scene when someone is found, and it's like this: none of this makes any sense to what we would think would happen to someone when they go missing, which is, you know, they get lost and maybe get hurt and fall, or an animal attacks them, or a person attacks them, and none of that fits these cases. Instead, you find people who have no obvious cause of death in many cases. When they can even have enough of a body to tell, there doesn't seem to be any animal evidence of animal attacks or anything like that. Plus, you have the weird clothes and item scattering.
I get a lot of people that say, well, why hasn't this been put together years ago? Why, if it was so easy to do, and I'm not saying it was easy to do, then why wasn't this discovered, you know, decades ago? And I got to remind people that when search and rescuers go out and find somebody, 90 to 95% of those people are volunteers. They're razor focused at finding the person, hopefully alive. And once they find that person, they're going home. And if it's a bad weather, like in Bobby's case, they're going home to a nice warm fire, and hopefully they found the little boy and he's okay. But the last thing they're going to do is hang around and talk like we're talking right now. And the truth is that most search and rescue is done intimately in a valley or a city or a county or a city. And those counties or cities don't look at the big picture like we're looking at it here. I mean, I've documented, I think, 9 countries now where this is happening, and I've probably read 6,000 or 7,000 case files to glean it down to these, you know, several hundred that match. And search and rescue people don't have the time to do that. They've got other professions and things, and there's nobody looking at it from 10,000 feet. They're only looking at it from ground level.
And the other thing you note repeatedly is that if someone is presumed dead, they're no longer on the list of the missing.
Boy, that is something that really, really bothers me. And as an example, there's somebody who dies in the woods, and let's say they're not found, and the wife has to get their benefits from Social Security. They need a death notification certification from the courts in order to activate the benefits. Say you own a house with somebody, you can't even sell the house because the person is technically still alive. So they go to court and they get a notification of death. Well, and the courts say he's dead. Well, that's exactly what the National Park Service and the National Forest Service wants, because no longer is the person missing. He's wiped off every roll everywhere. And the only way you can find that is delving into archives on a specific name search to find that person. And then you figure out, my God, the person went missing in the same area where 4 other people went missing, but they're not listed on anybody's rolls anywhere as a missing person. How is that? And then I found out from the Park Service that there's a criteria called missing presumed dead. Well, they're presumed dead, and they're no longer missing, so it's not an active case file. Yet, damn, they're still missing.
And also these clusters, they're not like they don't happen all in 1958. These are spread out over a lot of times a century at this point.
And again, I explain this out, and I say, well, if 5 people went missing in 2 years in a small city or a small rural area, that entire community would be in an uproar.
Yep.
What's happening? What's going on? We need somebody to look into this. But I spread those identical 5 cases out over, say, 40 years. Well, now you've gone through 2 or 3 rounds of different police officers and sheriffs. Don't remember what happened 30 years ago, let alone 40 years ago. Yet it's cookie cutters of the same incident happening, but they're spread out over times, so there's no flashing yellow light that anyone's looking at.
Right, right. So, I mean, you're probably the first person to ever correlate this on such a massive scale.
Yeah, I don't know anybody else that's ever been so ignorant to do it.
And how much time do you devote to a case? I mean, obviously, some of the old ones, you can only get so much information. But, like, on average, how much time do you think you devote to each case once you find a case that fits the criteria?
You know, that's hard to say, because a lot of the newer cases, I'll call up the sheriff or RCMP or whoever, and I'll talk to them, and I'll see what I can get out of them. Or I'll do an FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, and try to get it from a group of individuals in the government. And it really just depends. There's a case right now I'm looking at a national park where I cannot believe I missed it and nobody else has ever heard of it. And it involves a small person who disappeared there decades ago. And it is an absolute whodunit. She was never found. Nobody ever wants to talk about it. The Park Service won't give up the case file. it's one of those classic cases. You go, this is why the National Park doesn't want to give us a list of missing people. Because I think if we really knew how many people went missing, it would make us stand up and take note.
Have you had anyone, any families that have gone, of people who have gone missing, contact you?
Yes. Yes, I have. And those are some of the hardest days I've ever spent in my life. Because these people are great people. And they've lost a loved one, and they look to the one group that they know will help them. And in one instance, it was the National Park Service. And their last name was the Stellings. And the Stellings lost their dad at Mesa Verde National Park, and he just disappeared. Well, we sent a crew of ours, and myself went down there, because it's hard to believe what the Stellings said happened and how they were being treated by the Park Service. I mean, this was near the kind of the midsection of us making the movie, and we go, we got to see this. We got the permits. We went down there. And I think Mr. Stelling had been gone maybe a year and a half by that point. So his wife and the son went in, and they wanted to talk to the superintendent. And Soraya, the superintendent would not even come out and talk to those people. They wouldn't,
wow.
They wouldn't come out and talk to us. They wouldn't send a manager of the search to come and talk to us. The people, the family, were treated like second-class citizens at best. They gave us a person, a National Park Ranger, to talk to about other issues. He was ordered not to talk about the search for Stelling. And we kind of took him off the record and said, come on, what's going on here? And he goes, if I talk about it, I'll get fired. And he goes, I got specific orders. I said, I've never seen a superintendent or anybody in management, any government agency, treat somebody so rude. He just put his head down and he looked at the ground. He goes, I don't know what to say. I'm embarrassed.
Wow. Do you think it's like an intentional cover-up, or they just don't want bad publicity?
So years ago, I talked to Mr. Martin, the father of Dennis Martin. And
right.
He told me that he didn't think the superintendents had any real responsible decision-making at all. And he said, I can only talk about Dennis's case, Dave. And he said, I don't think they made it one decision. Every time he had to do anything, he had to call somebody. And he got a dictate on how to handle it. I've got a feeling that that's probably the way it is everywhere. And it may be because they're all looking out for their own backs and they don't want to take the responsibility of making a decision. Or maybe on these really big cases, they've got a dictate. You just follow whatever we're saying at headquarters. Whoever's calling the shots, who knows? I can tell you that I didn't believe that a family who lost a loved one would be treated that way. I never said that to them, but then after I saw it, my God, I could have cried with them, because you expect these people to bend over and help you in every way possible to find your loved one. These people wouldn't even talk to her.
And what do they have to lose by talking to them? That's the thing.
I wish I knew.
Now, you had started a petition against the Park Service at one point. Did you get anywhere with that?
That petition is still out there. If you go to canammissing.com on our website, look under the petition site, there was a professor out here in Denver that read my books. And she understood exactly what I was saying, and that is that there needs to be a public database that's searchable for the entire Department of the Interior, missing people on public lands. And she wrote it up, did an excellent job. I think we have about 6,600 signatures on it right now. We're aiming for 10,000, and then we'll go to a senator, and we'll ask for either congressional or Senate hearings about why they can't do this.
All right. Let's look at the case of Larry Wyckoff.
Well, Larry was only 15 years old. This happened in a small area of Sharon, Michigan, up on northern area, November 25th, 1977. He was a sophomore at Tower High School in a city called Warren. and his dad was an engineer for the U.S. Army in Warren. And I know people kind of, they seem to like to hear when parents are working for the Army when a kid goes missing for some reason, so I make that public. And the location was on the southeast side of the Manistee River near Sharon, Michigan. Well, on November 25th, Larry was camping in a trailer off Sharon Road, and you can look this up on a map, Sharon, right near Warren, right near the river with a group of friends, and they were hunting. Well, on November 25th, all of them left their trailer, and they hiked 2 miles east. Well, one of the friends wounded a buck, and the hunters tracked it for a long time. Eventually, they wanted to give up. But Larry said, no, 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 we wounded it good. You know, I'm going to keep tracking it for a while. I think I can find it. Well, at that point, all the hunters returned to their trailer for lunch except Larry. Well, a couple hours after lunch, he doesn't show up, so they start searching for him, and they couldn't locate him. And they decided at 3 o'clock to call the sheriff. Well, Larry was dressed warmly, snowmobile boots, coat, cap, gloves, carrying a rifle. And deputies got on scene, and they start searching right away. They had a tracking dog on scene the first hour he was reported missing. Didn't find a scent, couldn't track. On November 26th, the following day, a light snow started to fall. They had already requested a Coast Guard helicopter to fly into the scene and help. Well, they grounded that because of the weather. But they had 125 searchers on the ground. Fast forward to December 4th, the Michigan State Police sent their best tracking dogs to the location, and they couldn't find anything. So 10 days of searching, they found nothing. And the effort to locate Larry was terminated. Now, you fast forward about 6 months to May of 1978, and the sheriff's office decides to do something unique, and they make a public call out to psychics to help them find Larry. Well, one of the psychics drew a map of what they saw from the sky looking down. And the deputy took that sketch, because he didn't recognize it, to several local residents to see if anyone could recognize this area of high grass, a beaver pond, and a creek that was in this drawing. Well, they went to a guy who was an old-time trapper in the area, and he trapped the area for 60 years. And he said right away, he goes, I know where this is. And he said it's a 1.5 miles about from where Larry was last seen in a location called the South Swamp. Swamps come up a lot in these stories, by the way. Well, again, the initial effort to go out and find him in this area failed, so they get a hold of the trapper again, and he went out with them, and they found the body right away. And it was in an area that had been searched by searchers many times. So the question comes back, he's only 1.5 miles from where he was last seen, and 90% of people in this scenario would be found in 2 miles or less. And 12 canines failed, helicopters failed, 2 airplanes failed, and hundreds of professional searchers who combed that area failed. Cause of death was listed as exposure. And in this instance, again, found near water, he had plenty of clothing to survive. So how he died of exposure doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And one thing I put in the book, in the back, is a list of safety items that every hunter should be aware of. And one thing is that the international distress call for a hunter is 3 shots in succession. Boom, boom, boom. Wait 20, 30 minutes, do it again. And then eventually, your friends know you're in trouble, and they start honing in on that. Now, Larry never did that, and he probably didn't even know to do it. And in fact, I'm guessing probably a majority of hunters don't even know to do it. And when you read about a lot of these cases, a lot of hunters aren't even carrying more than a couple rounds of ammunition. Well, you should be carrying at least 20 rounds just to help you in these cases like this. So, Larry, I don't know what to say about that. It's pretty interesting that a psychic was able to write exactly where he was at.
Yeah, and it was someplace he wasn't prior.
No.
Have you have many of these cases involved psychics? I don't remember you writing too much about psychics being involved in many of these.
You know, in the hundreds and hundreds of cases, there's only a small, small handful where a psychic was able to be useful like this.
That doesn't surprise me necessarily. I think that type of thing is very hit and miss.
Well, you know what I tell people when they ask me, they said, well, have you ever used a psychic? And I always say, for sure, I'm open to it. But has anyone ever met a psychic who said who ever admitted that they weren't maybe really bad? All of them think they're really good.
They all think they're 100%.
And what I tell people is that psychic doesn't need me. Buy a book, go find one person in that book, and you've got me sold. But they always say, well, have you ever gone out? Well, psychic can go do this on their own. Or if they know where the body's at, tell me. I'll go do it. But you don't hear that. And
yeah.
I've never had a psychic tell me they know where a body's at.
Oh, this guy obviously was pretty close.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, those hits do happen. There are some psychics with pretty good records with the police. It's just not overly common.
No, and again, I'm not somebody that's going to discount everyone. I'm open to it. And especially the ones that have shown success that don't ask for compensation. A while ago, this is a kind of a funny story. A while ago, a fairly famous radio broadcaster told me that they wanted to introduce me to this group of remote viewers. And they thought that they could find a couple bodies for me. And I said, oh, that's outstanding. And I said, now tell them that they're going to be vetted real good because I'm not going to put them in the proximity of the victim's families just to be disappointed or worked or used. Oh, no, no, they would never do that. So when I'm on the phone with this organization, they said, oh, yeah, great, we want to help, we want to help. And then they lay a dollar figure down about how much money they need to do this.
Yeah.
I was pretty upset.
And that's just for them to try. That's not how much they want if they're successful.
No. No, it's just to try.
Well, you know, I mean, if they said, hey, you know, we want this much money if we can find the body, I think that's one thing.
You know, sir, I think there's some things in life that you don't charge for. And if somebody's missing a child or a loved one and you want to get paid for finding the person because you have some special abilities, then I think morality should rule out. And sometimes you got to just do the good things in life and do them the right way. And I think this is one of those instances where, hey, you do all you can to help these people. I know I would.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not disagreeing with that. It's just, you know, like when you want to be paid up front for something you can't even necessarily promise you can do. I mean, you can promise it, but you can't prove you can do it.
Right. That's exactly the scenario.
It's like someone saying, well, I can probably fix your roof. Give me this money and we'll see what happens.
Right. Right. And if it leaks, we're not fixing it.
Yeah, exactly. Except obviously now we're dealing with people's emotions and their families. Time of disappearance. A lot of it seems to happen in the evening, doesn't it?
Late afternoon, early evening. That's what I tell everyone.
And it's interesting because that's like the liminal period of the day. It's the changeover from day to night.
That's right.
And a lot of paranormal stuff seems to happen around liminality. So, I mean, not that this is necessarily paranormal. We don't know what it is. But if there's a paranormal connection, I'm wondering how much that plays a part.
Oh, that's been brought up many, many times. And, you know, I think when it became pretty obvious that hour was going to stand out, I think almost everybody who had an open mind kept going to that point.
Yeah. Okay. People can get this book only on your website, correct?
Yes. Please don't go to Amazon. I think they're charging like $125 for it right now. Go to Can-Am,
wow.
Canadian American, canammissing.com, and it's $25.
Okay. And that goes for all of your books. None of them are actually on Amazon.
We don't put anything on Amazon.
Why did you decide not to?
Well, I had a pretty decent IT background, and I knew I could get some pretty good visibility on the net through Google search, Yahoo search, and if you just type in missing 411 on Yahoo or Google, we're the number one hit. So, you know, why pay an exorbitant fee to Amazon when we have our own website?
True, true. But I think a lot of people just go to Amazon by default. Doesn't matter what it is, they're just going to go to Amazon.
And then if you look at the description of the book on Amazon, on almost every description, our website is the very first thing you see.
Nice. And occasionally I'll hear people complain, oh, these books are way too expensive. It's like, no, they're $25. Go to the website. Stop going to Amazon.
Yeah, exactly.
And you do offer them as a full set.
Yeah, there's a box set that we sell with a sleeve, and it's a nice collector's edition. We've had that for the last 2 weeks now.
Okay. And that's how many missing 411 books are there now?
Six.
Six. Okay. And you have a map as well?
Yeah, there's a cluster map of North America that we put out. This is the second version, so it's been updated. 59 clusters are on there. You can read every name on the map.
Nice, yeah, because the map on the back, I mean, you can get the idea, but obviously there's too many flags on there to be able to make out anything out clearly, but it does give you an idea of where the clusters are.
Exactly.
How big is the map?
Oh, it's wall size. I think it's 36 by 25.
Nice. Yeah, I guess that would make it easier to read.
Yeah.
Are there any plans to make any of these digital?
No, and I get asked that. There's, you know, there's eight different types of ebooks out there, and if I do one, then I've got to do all of them. And it's just a distraction, honestly. I mean, writing a book is a big deal, and mm-hmm. I could barely get that done. And then to focus on digital versions, it's just more time away from me not working on understanding these cases.
Okay. All right.
Okay. That's part one. Part two will be on next week. Again, if you're a patron, it's available on the patron site right now, the whole thing in its entirety. And there will be a little extra piece. It's only about 3 or 4 minutes long. All right. To take you out, we're going to hear some Sax Mile, because I always thought this song was creepy and somehow applicable to the stuff we've been talking about. The song is called Agilacy, and it's Cherokee for My Grandma. See you next week.
It's my restlessness that brings me here again. Each time I'll come out a little farther. The family's used to it by now, I suppose. And Grandma stopped her teasing. Sure, when I was younger, with all that talk of the boogeyman. But who could blame a 5-year-old with all the dried gourds and that creaky windmill? I guess it didn't do anything but make me want to come out and see for myself. It's just so looming. I've covered every square inch of this place at some point or another. Yeah, and over there behind that tree line is the Crawford's Pond. It's just that as that sun goes down behind those trees, it's like a change comes over everything. During harvest and into winter, each night I'll excuse myself from the table, throw on my jacket, and head out into the middle of this field. And with each step, I'll recall the things Grandma used to say to herself when she was working in the garden or maybe putting us kids to bed. Didn't make much sense at the time, she'd say, nine times will the cats play, and after that they'll have gone away. Bear the watcher and the sage. Dark as night when moon glow, come the smell of fall I know, mine the specter and the sage. Used to sound creepy, but now I know what you meant. And maybe now she knows the mystery.